Therefore, we say that when we want the individual to be still and know, we want the individual to change his entire basic formula for life. It doesn't mean he can't speak. It doesn't mean he can't have ideas. But he has to have only things that work together for good. The body, mind, emotions must be brought into harmonic relationships. There must be no discords in the compound of the person. It doesn't mean he necessarily is awfully well advanced. He isn't perfect. He isn't above making an occasional mistake. But when he makes a mistake, he knows it and he's sorry. And when he's not too wise, he may be much deeper in the mysteries of his own inner life. So the problem is that in stillness now is the end of conflict, not the end of function. It is that no longer will the individual be in a continuous disturbance with himself. He will not regret what he did yesterday and build a new regret today. Pythagoras advised this doctrine of recollections to accomplish freedom from habit patterns. He advised his disciples that every day they should live their lives over again backward for that day. See what they did right and what they did wrong, and determine to correct any mistake that was made during that day. Recognize it, correct it, and outgrow it, and reach the condition in which it would not be repeated. So what we're asking for, really, is a good-natured person of kindly disposition who has managed to get over griefs and grievances, who is able to live in pleasant relationships with other people, who is not jealous, who does not tear down reputations, and doesn't lock in feuds with anybody, who holds no violent dislikes over subjects they do not understand, do not take sides on problems they do not know, but whatever happens, remain open and ever watching for the good, and watching and rewarding only the best of their own conduct. This means a more or less simple life. One way that the medievals found to gain this simple life was by joining the clergy. They became monks, lived in monasteries, worked in gardens, spent most of their time in prayer and meditation. But this didn't work quite well either, for in this case, the isolation was the individual arming himself against himself. He was determined to destroy the opportunities to make mistakes and gain virtue in that way. It's not done that way. It doesn't work. The individual does not recover from his mistakes because he locks himself away from temptation. Because temptation is still there, and all kinds of internal pressures affect him and afflict him even while he is in a monastic existence. The answer to the whole thing was stay in the world, but be able to live your own inner life without worry and fear. And if other people wish to ridicule it, let them. But do not resent their ridicule. It's not worth it. Do that which your inner life tells you is right. And in order to do that, you have to get a message. Now, messages coming from the inner life are often mistaken. Very often, what we consider to be a vision is merely a way of supporting our own personal attitudes. When visions begin to support our right to be wrong, we have a good reason to question the visions. Visions can be nothing but nightmares. They can be nothing but psychological expressions of our own defects. They can reveal to a clinical trained psychiatrist or psychologist just what is wrong with our dispositions and why we're in trouble. This type of vision or dream is of no basic value except as a warning. And the individual does not need to have an elaborate analysis of this. For if he has pressures, he will have dreams. And most of the dreams will be related to his pressures, either justifying them or trying to help him to fulfill the things that have created the pressures. So we don't go on that level. But if there are no pressures, if there are no intensities, if the individual is living a very quiet, reasonable, and natural life, perhaps he'll be a little like Jacob Boehme, the great German mystic. He was raised and educated as a shoemaker. He was an apprentice shoemaker. Finally, we got his papers and became a master shoemaker and lived in the little town of Görlitz all his life. He was married and had children. He attended the Lutheran Church, and he was a very simple person with only the education possible from a local school, which probably taught him only enough to read the Bible. So this man quietly, peacefully, made a strange compact with himself. He resolved to live as best he could in his simple way, the best he knew. And he was a very quiet man and a very charitable man. And when the Lutheran communion turned against him very bitter, he never for one moment showed the slightest resentment. While they were denouncing him in the church, he was sitting in his pew and listening to it. He was unwilling to even pick a quarrel with the men who were accusing him of heresy. Fortunately, at that time, the Inquisition was not in control in Germany, so all they could do was downgrade him. But actually, in this very simple family way, they say a very wonderful father, a faithful husband, a good friend, and an absolutely honest craftsman who marked every shoe he made and guaranteed it. To this simple man came some of the most extraordinary visions recorded in history. One day, while he was working in his shop, he had a chance to look up, and he saw a ray of light striking a pewter plate on the wall. This ray of light struck him in the eyes, and in that moment he had a vision of another world. And this vision he had of another world had none of the peculiarities that we associate with sectarianism. It was a world which he had not even a terminology for. He borrowed all kinds of words from his friends and neighbors because he had no words. He also was able to gain some terminology from alchemy and astrology and other subjects, but he used them always in his own way, not the way they were originally being used in the communities. Little by little, Boehme discovered in himself a strange and wonderful truth that was the basis of all his thinking and all his living. He said that in the very beginning there was nothing in the universe but peace, that this peace reached everywhere, and everyone was in peace with everyone else. And they talked to God, and God answered them in the voice of a small child, a very gentle child, not much older than themselves, because he was speaking to common people and not to great scholars. And they were all peaceful until along came Lucifer. And Lucifer was self-will, and by self-will fell the angels. And when Lucifer asked deity for certain privileges, he was a faithful cherub at that time, God spoke again in the voice of the little child and said what was necessary. And Lucifer said, "Oh no, I don't like this. I don't want to live in a universe that is ruled by a small child. And if the deity can't speak out the great and glorious words I want to hear, I'm going to take over the job." Remember, this is in Low Dutch in Germany. So he said, "I'm going to take over. I'm going to run the universe now." So he challenged deity and said, "I'm not going to do these things. If you're just a puny little deity living in a space without anything around you except a baby voice, I'm going to show you how to run this thing." And at the moment that he said that was the moment of the great disobedience. And in an instant, the heavens completely changed. Everything changed. The sky was filled with great spiritual powers. And in the midst of them was seated or placed the ineffable deity with all power, all splendor, all skills, and a thunder and rumbling voice that could be heard everywhere. And it is thus that the pride of Lucifer opened the abyss of the self, opened the world of sorrow and pain, because he tried to take over the management of the universe, and because he could see no God until he disobeyed, and then the whole glory of heaven broke upon him. Now, there's something about this. It's an almost a beautiful myth or legend that can be carried right on down. For the man taking over the universe because God didn't seem big enough to handle the job is something that we all might think about occasionally. Also, in all the problems that we have, when we think of the universal divine plan as too weak to handle us, to take care of our problems, so that we have to suddenly become helpers in this deal, we may get into serious trouble. But Bamy was essentially a great mystic, and he pointed out that when the human being becomes aware of the realities and uses them properly, the great grief or the great sorrow fades away again, and man and God live together in infinite community, always man obeying that which was eternally ordained to be obeyed. So in this way, Bamy had his statement of silence, of peace, that was disrupted by the rise of human faults, human emergencies, and the forever human optimism and complacency. So that to be still is to know the universe as stillness. To be still is to hear the voice of God and the voice of a small child. To disobey is to bring down upon oneself the thunder of an absolutely immutable power. To obey, we do not know there are laws. When we break them, we discover to our sorrow that we have not been very wise. So we're going to try to think in terms of a quietude that is free from ulterior motive. And this was what Zen attempted to do in India. And this is what Taoism attempted to do in China. This also is the mystery of Neoplatonism and the ideals of Pythagoras. It was the idea that man only comes into trouble when he does it wrong. As long as he is right, he doesn't know there are any laws. Because by keeping them perfectly, everything is serene and well-balanced. But the moment self-interest takes over, the power of the abyss is loosened upon us. So we think now of quietude as just quietly doing the things that are right, peacefully doing the things that must be done in peace, and performing all good deeds in the name of the one sovereign good upon which we all depend and from which we must gain all our life and resource. Now, the mystics have found out that if we live this quiet inner life, that we can carry every responsibility of the outer life with dignity. There is no need for us to go around depriving ourselves of everything. We only have to deprive ourselves of those things which were never any good for us in the first place. We only have to get over what was wrong. We are never punished for what is right. But if we get these things into a quietude and peacefulness, then this achieved condition is the opener of the door. This is the power that makes possible for us the actual direct participation in reality. It is that power which comes to us when we do not interfere or condition that power. When we keep it principles, integrity and in right. We are like what the Chinese sage has said, that in the ancient days, the wise slept without dreams. There was no dreaming about mistakes or therapeutic dreams. There is simply a great quietude. And in this quietude, a perfect peace, the heavens open, and the reality affirms itself in our lives. The story of the fable of Christ knocking at the door is much in this thoughtfulness. That which is real knocks at the door when we listen. But when we do all the talking ourselves, we cannot hear the gentle voice of truth or note the gentle knocking on the door. It is in peace and quietude alone that we can open the doors. If it opens the doors means that we make ourselves receptive to a higher level of consciousness. We make ourselves receptive to the experiences of the inner life. We have a victory of soul over circumstance. We have a victory of reality in ourselves over the errors and illusions of daily living. As a result, we are in peace. We are quiet. Now, in the old initiation rites, we were usually subject to very serious tragedies. In the ancient mystery rituals, the candidate was given very firm and terrible tests. There were even degrees in which his life itself might be hazarded, unless he was right. And in all these things, he had to fulfill the great tests of life. He had to recapitulate his own existence and go through a series of harrowing circumstances which would result finally in his attainment of oneness with the inner consciousness. Well, maybe today we're still taking the same rituals. We don't call them rituals anymore. We call them mistakes of other people or inabilities of governors to govern, inability of the governed to govern himself. All these things we now call blames. Probably they are actually tests. Experiences which will never cease until we stop making the mistakes that cause the trouble. There will never be a time when social legislation can prevent the individual from making a mistake. And we can never have perfect leadership until we have an intelligent following. There must be dedicated followers and enlightened leaders. And in every case, the enlightenment means self-victory. The victory of the inner life over the outer circumstances, the outer temptations, the outer beliefs, the outer circumstances which lead to trouble. So the Buddhists and the Zen people, for instance, have a very quiet method of meditation. They sit quietly and they simply allow not a blank to set in. The idea is not to make the mind a blank. The idea is to make the mind a gentle disciple at the kneeling or seated at the foot of the reality within. The human becomes the chela of the divine, becomes the disciple of that which must always be the leader. And various ways these revelations come to people. Sometimes they may come in an occasional dream, which is a vision, or a real spiritual experience, which is comparatively rare. But all spiritual experiences must be doubted if the individual who has them has not conquered the common mistakes of himself. Anyone who believes an extrasensory experience, who is still incapable of the direct control of his own life constructively, must be afraid of imposture. And any organization that promises the individual that he can become great without becoming good is also a very dubious organization. There can be no rising upward into the higher levels of consciousness except through a kind of meditative discipline. And what is meditation in this case? It is not sitting in a corner somewhere with your eyes closed and your fist clenched tightly. Meditation in this case is the quiet recognition, realization of the values of life as they have been presented to us in daily experience. Meditation helps to bring us a new way of it being useful, a new way of solving or helping to solve problems around us. Now, we can say with all meditation practices that nobody can solve anybody else's problems. This is true. Therefore, the fact that we think we are solving them is not quite really true. The part that is beneficial to us is the fact that we have given up something of ourselves because we love someone else more. This is the great gift. And the great gift, in turn, going to them, may give them the courage to see what we have done and do it for themselves. Every individual who becomes happy must make himself happy. There is no possible way of other people making anyone really happy. And any apparent happiness that arises without the control and direction of inner faculties is going to come on the rocks one of these days and be seriously shipwrecked. All these things are part of a large plan, a large purpose, a divine way of things. And in our quietude, in the small voice, the voice of the silence will speak. And the voice will be like the voice of God in Vaimi's vision. It will be a small, quiet voice, never a thundering of power, never a vast expression of some determination, never a final order descending from on high. But it will be the quiet voice of a gentle person telling us something we ought to know, and telling it as though we were beloved children and not because we were great people. The recognition of these experiences comes often in various small ways. I know, for instance, one case in which an individual was very fond of a garden. They loved to plant flowers and things of that nature. And they always loved flowers. It was a very kindly relationship. It was a beautiful, quiet relationship. And one day this person, while looking at one of the flowers that was particularly beautiful, had something happen. Suddenly, this flower seemed to speak. It didn't say anything, but it seemed to speak, and suddenly the law of that flower burst into the mind of this very kindly gardener. The law of the flower became a symbol of the whole unfolding of the cosmos. The flower became an infinite symbol of an infinite purpose. And it is. It is a part of a great and infinite purpose. But most of those who look at the flower don't see it that way. But this person saw it that way. Saw the flower as suddenly bursting forth into a perfect symbolism of the universe. It was there all the time, but at that moment, the reality in the individual picked it up and brought it out. The message came from something beyond the mind, something beyond the emotions, but an infinite impression of reality, which meant that the person had for a moment's contact with one of these levels of higher insight. Plotinus, the Neoplatonist, said that in his lifetime, that only on two occasions had he been lifted up into the presence of reality, and that for only a few seconds. But that became the most powerful experience of life, and all of life from then on was never the same as it had been before. The same might be said, too, of Luther Burbank with his love of flowers and plants. Here's a man who was able, very obviously, to influence flowers and plants. I saw him one afternoon and we talked about these things, and he said that he could talk with the plants, and the plants answered him. And when he said he wanted them to do something, they did it. So several big universities sent classes and students and so forth to see how Mr. Burbank was taking the spines off of cactus so they could be used in the desert to feed cattle. They did exactly what he did and got nowhere. And he explained that the reason they didn't get the result was because they hadn't talked to the flowers and plants. They hadn't told those plants what he wanted them to do, what they should do, and how they could help by doing it. But if you talk with them and understand them, even in silence, you commune with them, not as little things with a root, but as reality, and wound up in a magnificent little mystery, that they obey. And he told me, he said, the only person I ever had that was able to do it was an old Chinese gardener. He said, this gardener watched me and listened. And from that time on, he always talked to the plants. And they did what he wanted them to also. He said, you've got to understand life. Life is not you and nothing, or you and something that doesn't mean anything. And all the flowers and birds and animals and creatures of the universe are real. And to each level of man's thinking, some form of life becomes immediately instructive. And by accepting the instruction, a great new dimension of consciousness is achieved. This is the only way reality can be proven. It can't be proven in laboratories. It can't be proven in anything except all of nature. The very planet and everything that is on it bears absolute and eternal witness to reality. But the reality is not obvious to the person who doesn't know what the term means or doesn't know what the experience of it means. To us, humanity is a unique thing. Other things are different. We're now beginning to take a little interest in animal life. But at the same time, we haven't found the realities in these things. We haven't found that by looking at the most simple living thing, that we come face to face with a truth, a reality, an inevitable, which we can never influence, but which we can learn to accept and obey. So this is what really opening the door is. This is why the Indian went out and did vigil. He did vigil because he knew that the air was filled with life. He knew that everything that existed was real. Now, he couldn't come back and explain all this to his fellow tribesmen, although most of them probably were sympathetic to it. But the proof of the fact was something else. The proof was that when he went out as a healer and sat and did vigil, the true ones, sent symbols to him so that he would know what to do. And Fa, when he was up here with me, he said that a little light appeared somewhere on the earth around him, around a little plant or a little flower or a weed or even some little small animal or creature. And he knew instantly that which the light was around was the thing that was necessary to heal the sick man for whom he was praying. So he took this material, usually an herb, which he had never used before. He had no botanical knowledge, but he had seen in a meditation that this was it. And he took it and he made a tea with it and he gave it to the sick man. Then the reality proved itself. The man got well. That was the only reality that could be demonstrated. All the others could be, it may be a mistake, but if the man got well by a mystical experience, then that experience was real. And it's the same all the way along. We cannot get the positive demonstrations that we seek of all these things. The only thing we know is that the closer we can come to reality, the closer we come to peace, happiness, and health. And the further we get from reality, the more rapidly our problems multiply. Now, for those of us who are just, kind of going along on the way and haven't got too far, there are things we can do ourselves each day. We can begin to quiet the prominent causes of confusion. There is no meditation based upon some esoteric exercise that can ever work if the individual has not accomplished a transformation within himself. This was the highest phase of alchemy. Alchemy was to make gold out of base metals. And spiritual alchemy was to discover the eternal gold of reality in all things, which can be released and brought into manifestation by art. And art in this case is the beauty. It is the skill. It is the wonder by which we do what is right because it is right. This type of thing is something that has come down to us for a long, long time. And it will continue to come down to us until we obey it. We must find the only answer that there is, and that is the utopian answer, that the human being must live the fullness of humanity, of his own endowment. He must manifest all the manifestations of the condition of the level of life upon which he exists. And having done this, he may then request very quietly, or may not even have to request, because realities perpetuate themselves. We expect to go on to the next level of understanding and insight. We are held behind by the ballast of our own mistakes. And until we are able to master those and redeem them or restore the integrities in them, we will remain in trouble. So the first thing to do, if you're really anxious to get on to the discipleship principle in nature, is to start in and prove worthiness. Prove as the ancients did in the initiation tests. When the disciple wanted to enter into the mysteries of Eleusis in Greece, the first thing that was done was that his community was invited. The archon, a leader of the community, was invited to tell what they thought of this young person, whether he was a good person, whether he was a good son or daughter, because women were initiated. Was this person a good, worthy, honorable person? And if the city father said yes, and that he had never been in trouble, that he'd always been a good member of the community, that was a good mark for the person. If he had been troublesome, he would never have been admitted any further. Then, if that was true, they then went to his teacher. Where did this young person study, and what did he study? So they found the master, an old sophist of some kind, who had instructed him. And they said, was he a good student? Yes. Was he quick-minded and able to understand? Yes. Well, what did he give him to study? Mathematics, astronomy, and music. And that is correct. Then they would probably call the boy to be given the examinations at the temple itself. And if he passed these successfully, he was placed on a 5-year probationship, in which it was assumed that he would take the hope of going on as the basis of a great improvement in himself. He was to go back to his ordinary life and do those things which he believed would be sanctioned, justified, and approved by the temple. He had to be virtuous and pure and clean and healthy all through this 5-year period. He must have no trace of egotism. He must not look down on others who had been rejected. He must simply live a clean, natural, honorable life, serving his family, keeping the rules of the community, and developing his own inner life. At the end of that time, he was put into the tests. And these tests were very severe on many occasions. But they were tests of every courage that the individual had. And every opportunity was given to be corrupted or to be sidetracked. But if he succeeded and lived on and was able to pass the final test, he was brought forth from the porch of the temple and crowned with the laurel wreath and declared to be an official and recognized member of the religious group. This then became something that was so important that in the presence of an initiate of the mysteries, even the king of the country could not remain seated. The divine instruction took precedence over all material honors. And initiation was more important than to win a great military victory or to attain to be an archon of the state or to become a leader in any external affair. He might win the Olympic Games 10 times, but it was not nearly as much of an honor as to have the wreath of the initiate placed upon him. From that time, he was bound by oaths greater than himself that he would never corrupt, never compromise, never in any way abuse, and never falsely reveal to the unworthy the instruction he had received, and would never use that instruction for personal physical gain. Now, those were pretty rough instructions, but at the same time, they are the type of thing that we must all ultimately face. Fortunately, we don't face it all at once. We don't have to do all that is right at one time. But little by little, day by day, we are supposed to discipline our mistakes, gradually gaining control over them, correcting attitudes that are not conducive to common good. And in this way, by a certain regular order of things, come finally to the point where the interior takes complete control of the exterior, and the individual lives from the root of his own reality, that he is now no longer a person. He is now a great soul in a body. He is an illuminate. He has achieved the end that the physical world can bestow. And he has now available to him all the knowledge of his race, all the wisdom of nature around him, and all the love of the deity whom he represents and who brought him forth. So these are the things that open the gates of integrities. And these are the only ways that the gates of wisdom can truly be opened. And I've got a little announcement I want to make this morning. We have with us a friend who had a birthday last Monday, but we didn't speak Sunday, so this is the first chance we've had. And that is our good friend, Gilbert Olson. Well, many of you know. And Gilbert Olson has been a personal friend of mine for 45 years and has served us here ever since the society was built, practically. And today we kind of give him a little note of welcome and appreciation on a little belated birthday party for him. It's not going to be a real party, but it's going to be a chance for those of you who know him to congratulate him on having made it, and also to point out that a big change has come in Gilbert's life. He has left Downey, where he lived for very many years, and he's now moving to Glendale in order that he can be over here more often. So we want you to all say hello for him.